You're listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Amanda King, and in this episode, ECSP Director Lauren Reese and I catch up with longtime friends and colleagues of ECSP, John Matthews and Ingrid Timbo, of the Alliance for Global Water Adaptation, or better known as AQUA. John is the Executive Director of AQUA and has been working at the intersection of water with climate adaptation and resilience since 2007. And Ingrid is the Policy Director at AQUA and manages AQUA's broad policy portfolio. In our conversation, they share details of their ongoing projects and what they see in the lead up to next week's COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
Ingrid and John, we're so glad to have you here with us. Why don't you let us know what you're busy working on in the lead up to COP?
Sure, thanks for having us. John, do you want to kick us off?
Sure, I'm John Matthews, really grateful to be here. We have been going to COPs since 2009 and trying to talk about adaptation and resilience from a water perspective for a really long time now. And it's changed a lot over the years. I think it was mostly people asking for quite a few of the early COPs, like, why are you here? And why do you want to talk about adaptation, and why do you want to talk about water? And that script has really flipped. I think now adaptation resilience, especially in Glasgow last year at COP26, in part because of the UK and their hosting, but also I think just because there was a real upwelling of interest in middle and lower income countries to say, we can't wait any longer.
Right.
We actually, you know, we will sort out the carbon stuff, but we have our real serious investment problems, disaster problems, problems with our ecosystems, with our communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to talk about adaptation, and that meant automatically that water was right up at the top of the agenda. And so things have gotten, I would almost say, kind of dramatically easier. And maybe like a quick example, the IPCC released their sixth assessment report in a long series going back to the early 90s in March of this year. And it was completely lost in their messaging because of Ukraine. I don't know, maybe Putin was trying to shut out the IPCC. But one of the things that the IPCC said that was really interesting, for those of us that were looking at that at the back of the newspaper, it was that water-based adaptation had to be at the core of all of our adaptation work.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put in 500 pages of examples.
Wow.
So and we find Ingrid and I are both water people. We find that actually climate people come to us now, and they say,
mm-hmm.
all of our problems are water problems. How do we focus on adaptation resilience with water?
Well, yeah, so much of how people experience climate change is through water,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether it's too much or too little, or sort of changing quality. That's really interesting and heartening to hear that it's become sort of more like risen on the agenda. I imagine that with the COP taking place in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, and then looking to COP28 in UAE, water in the Middle East is certainly a hot topic too. Could you talk about how you see water sort of shaping the climate conversation at the COP, and then vice versa, right? How is climate change sort of shaping the relationship or the conversation about water and the relationship between Middle Eastern countries? We have an article coming out by Peter Schwartzstein in the next week or so looking at water in the Middle East, and it's really interesting and thinking about how the role water has played in relationships among Middle Eastern countries and how that might be changing looking into the future.
I'll give a quick answer to the first part of the
sure.
question, then hand it off
yep.
to Ingrid. So we started working, partnering directly with UNFCCC, the UN agency that leads in climate change, starting back around 2000, 2017, 2018, and in just that year alone, we advised over 100 countries on their national climate plans, their NDCs, from a water perspective, you know, how they think about risk, what do they look for, how to think about opportunities. You know, we as kind of three regional workshops, each one about a week long, and that was transformative for us too, because it really told us that countries were serious about their NDCs, that their staff needed a lot of help too. They were often quite junior staff in kind of new positions. They were often very aspirational, idealistic, but they needed chops. You know, they needed mm-hmm. hooks, and so we started thinking, like, what is it that we can really do in that space to help support them? And that's mm-hmm. a program that Ingrid and some of our other colleagues at AGWA have been leading.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I would just say, like, also, Lauren, what you said earlier, right, about how water, you know, the way that climate change is experienced is through water. And so when you're talking about the Middle East in particular, obviously, you know, for them, it is really extreme.
Right.
And so mm-hmm. you're looking at some of the most water-scarce countries in the world. At the same time, you know, we're talking to Egypt and others, it's not just about water scarcity
mm-hmm.
either. They're also having flash floods
mm-hmm.
now. So it's just more variability,
right.
more sensitivities, these sorts of things. So it's actually really complex and complicated, but this is something that they're already working on. But I would say where there is a challenge and an opportunity, I guess, to work on these things a bit more is around coherence and coordination. And this is not just in the Middle East or
sure.
North Africa. This is everywhere. This is here in the U.S. I mean, and so one of the things that John alluded to that we're working on with countries now is how do they integrate climate resilient water management across their national climate plans. And so this is a project we were calling the calling the Water Tracker. And it's been going on in kind of a pilot phase for about a year and a half
mm-hmm.
now. And the idea behind it is exactly that. We are looking at their national climate commitments, both under the UNFCCC, so these are things like nationally determined contributions, NDCs, national adaptation plans, NAPs, but also looking, you know, do they have a national climate strategy? What's their national development planning look like? What are their sector plans? Because water is a universal resource, as we are thinking about, you know, water becoming more variable in a lot of different places, we really need to be managing it in this more holistic manner. And so what the Water Tracker is trying to do is understand where water is explicitly included in those plans, and where it might be implicitly included, and where there might be those gaps, and how can we help countries to manage water resources in a way that's going to support their goals, both for climate, but also for disaster risk, for sustainable development, et cetera, et cetera. Biodiversity, et cetera.
And you're looking across, like going back to your point about
yep.
coherence, you're looking across their policies to
yep.
make sure that they're the policies are talking to one another,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are people behind the policies critically talking to one another.
Yeah.
And a lot of
yeah.
times that just doesn't happen for a lot of, you know, institutional reasons, funding reasons. You know, if it was easy to do, it would be
yeah.
done already. So
yeah.
we know that it's complicated, but really trying to start some of those conversations. And I think that's the direction, you know, getting back to COP and what we're doing there, that the COP is moving as well to kind of downscale from this global conference. You know, these moments are still
mm-hmm.
really important. Sharm el-Sheikh will be important, you know,
yes.
because it you bring all the world leaders together. Everyone's very focused on this for 2 weeks. These conferences will remain important, but as we're starting to actually implement
mm-hmm.
plans, then we're looking much more at regional levels, national levels, and then even scaling down from there as well, because that's actually where the action's happening.
Right.
And connecting that.
People really make decisions.
Exactly.
Yeah. yeah.
So how do you make these global commitments, you know, actually happen? And so that's kind of the things
mm-hmm.
that we're we're looking at and that we'll be doing at COP this year.
Okay, can I give an example?
Yeah, please.
So I like to think about the choices that the country of Vietnam really faces right now. And Vietnam, it's quite a poor country. It's been a poor country for a long time, and it's really it's where China was, say, in the 1980s, or very early 1990s. It's where Thailand was, and maybe in the 70s or early 80s. You know, it's an agricultural based economy, and all of their water is 80% of it or more is really embedded in largely rice agriculture. So how do they develop? What are their models? You know, they're trying to think forward. We want to be maybe build up our manufacturing. We want to build up our service technology. We want to look more like Thailand. Maybe we want to even steer towards Taiwan. And that what that means is that they need to go from the equivalent of very basic electrical supplies. Like we have abundant, almost too much, even declining energy production in the U.S. because we have such a sufficiency. They're trying to go from like a one light bulb economy to like the fully electronic home entertainment center economy, and so that means that they need to make a lot more power generation. So from the climate change perspective, what are they going to do to make that electricity? They could spend currency and buy coal or natural gas from somebody. That's bad on the carbon side, so they don't want to do that if they can avoid it. They don't really have a lot of other natural resources. Solar is also kind of heavy up front. They don't have experience with it. Wind also a little bit kind of front loaded, kind of a long return. But they have hills, and that means that they have hydropower potential. And so for the last 10 years, they've been adding 10, 20 hydropower facilities a year. And what we're trying to do is say, first off, are you making sure that those hydropower facilities, that you've actually de-risked them, that they're going to be able to operate as the climate continues? They don't get into a kind of a Hoover Dam, Lake Mead situation.
Yeah.
Mm. That as their economy continues to grow, that they actually lose the investment. That's happening in places like Bhutan and Nepal already, Kazakhstan. So they don't want to go in that direction if they can avoid it. So the tracker is telling them, like, you need to make sure that those investments are resilient investments.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, that they need to think, what does resilient rice irrigation look like? How do we make sure that we're also controlling for elevated sea level rises, like super typhoons, extended droughts? Like, how do we make sure that we keep that part of the economy safe too? But the other thing that the tracker does is it takes it to the next level. And it also says, how do we balance this trade-off? As water starts to move from one part of the economy to this new part of the economy, that it goes from agriculture into energy and data and manufacturing, like, how do you figure out that transition and make sure that that transition cost is itself a resilient process? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Well, does that mean, like, making sure that the people whose livelihoods are based on the agriculture economy are also part of that transition?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, because that is not just where the water is, it's also where the people are.
Right, right, yeah.
So that's this is why, like, the EU, that they still invest really heavily in their agriculture sector. They don't have to do that in France or Denmark, but they do it because they say this is actually how we make sure that our rural economy is still itself
healthy,
stays healthy, and that it has some sense of kind of agency and power over its own future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even more important for Vietnam in this process. And there are lots of countries around the world, arguably like over 100, 150 countries that are kind of in the same transition space.
Totally.
I kind of want to get back to the COP question a little bit. And my question is around, so what do you two think is getting like the deserved attention, but also what isn't? And then kind of a two-parter. So looking beyond the COP, what are other like windows of opportunity that you're seeing for both the tool that you mentioned and also your broader work?
One of the things I feel really heartened by is that yesterday I was in a meeting with, there's a group that we've been working with for a few months. They approached us. They're based in the Jordan River Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And they focus on this kind of transboundary part of the Middle East. And it's interesting that they have three directors, three people who lead it. And there's one from Palestine.
Well, I mean, I think we know who you're talking about.
Well, one from Palestine,
yeah.
One
yeah.
from Jordan, and one from Israel. It's EcoPeace Middle
sure.
East.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's a great group. We've watched them for a long time, and we really admire them. So we were excited when they reached out for some help with a climate
mm-hmm.
Policy engagement and some technical support. But I was meeting with their team yesterday, the three directors, and it was the kind of new interesting piece in the room to me was that all three of them said that, and they said it over and over again over several hours, is that, you know, the political process about thinking about peace in the Middle East is so broken and so stuck. It's something like only like a 25 or 30% of Israel's, for instance, was interested in, say, a two-state solution, but something like 70% of the Israeli population said that what they were really interested in was how to co-adapt,
mm-hmm.
how to build resilience at a regional level,
right.
And
yeah.
that is really powerful.
Yeah.
That's where the momentum is, and so they're a very pragmatic organization, and so they've started to really shift their focus from saying, you know, we have a shared sense of risk, and it's not some superpower, it's not some kind of extraneous, it's not aliens that are invading,
mm-hmm.
It's not even COVID. Like what we really need to worry about is to worry about climate change in our shared resources,
yeah.
and if the risk is the risk is that they take kind of a castle-like approach to adaptation. They just start building the walls really high, to kind of cut themselves off,
right.
to
mm-hmm.
sever interdependence, and what happens then is the wall gets so high that it just collapses, right?
Yeah.
And you become so isolated and fragmented. But what they need to do, what I think that they're really investing in building the capacity and processes around, is to actually lower the walls and say, we are stronger together, and that's where the resilience comes from. And that's very moving. I mean, we've heard the same thing from the Arab League, through informal channels for several months already. And the Middle East, you know, we're a global network of water and climate professionals. And the Middle East has been like the quietest part of our map since our founding 12 years ago. And it is starting to get noisy, and it's noisy in a really good way. People want to work together in a way they haven't.
Yeah, well, get on Bromberg. He's such, and his colleagues have been such mm-hmm. leaders in this space, and there's so many lessons to be drawn from what they've managed to accomplish. And so that's great that you were able to connect and good to hear that there is sort of continued momentum
yes.
in that region.
Yeah.
Sorry, over to you.
No, and I mean, not only continued, but I think really enhanced. And,
mm-hmm.
It's something that we're hearing from a lot of different areas, you know, not just there. I mean, it's happening in Latin America as well. And so, I mean, I think that there's a lot.
It's happening in the Western states in the U.S.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Where we are, so which I'm all, yeah, as a former Colorado Basin resident, I'm always happy to hear that there's cooperation happening now. Not that it's easy, or that there aren't going to be some extreme challenges ahead, but this idea, you know, that really we do have to work together, and I think that there really
mm-hmm.
is an appetite for that. going back to something where maybe a little bit more fraught is the COP itself. And so, you know, you asked the question of kind of like what is being amplified at COP this year. No, certainly we are seeing, as was mentioned, you know, adaptation really take a bigger place on the global stage, brought on primarily from countries saying we need to be working on this now because it's happening. So a week does not go by now where we're not hearing about some sort of
headline storm,
flood, you know, drought, you know, the Horn of Africa or Pakistan or Indonesia, wherever, you know, Florida here in the U.S. So, you know, there's so much momentum around that now, and I only really see that kind of growing, and especially because this is being framed to be hosted by Egypt, being framed as an African COP for most African all African countries, really adaptation is a major priority for them. And so I think for sure we're going to see that continue to be a major area. Now, of course, the challenge there is who's paying for all of this. And so that is also a conversation that is, I would say, very, very challenging. They refer to it as loss and damage. That's only part of it, really, in our perspective. But that's definitely something that is going to be on the agenda, and it is going to be quite divisive, I would imagine. So it's a little bit the opposite direction, unfortunately, than what I feel like where we're going with countries themselves or even regional cooperation on the global stage. That remains very, very complex. So definitely we'll be seeing that, I would imagine. But also there's these other work programs, the GGA and the GST. So the GGA is the Global Goal on Adaptation. So we have, in the Paris Agreement, we have a global temperature goal. So on the mitigation side, reducing or keeping average mean temperature to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. We still technically could reach that goal. It's very unlikely at this point, but there is at least, there's a goal there. On the adaptation side, it's a lot more difficult because you can't just slap a number on it like that. And so one of the things that the countries have been wrestling with is how do we measure adaptation? How do we show that countries actually have been adapting? And so that is this global goal on adaptation. That process is ongoing for the next year. They're holding a bunch of workshops on it. But again, you know, it's a lot of talk, it's a lot of conversation, and where is that actually going? So I think that remains to be seen, but countries are really excited to be talking about it, at least, because for a long time they weren't even doing that. And so I was in Bonn in June for the first workshop and got to hear from a lot of the countries. And, you know, they're asking really, really tough questions, like, you know, especially from our small island states, you know, what are the hard and soft limits on adaptation? And, you know, are there definitions for these sorts of things? And how do we, you know, once we hit these hard limits, then what? And what do we do? You know, because we're facing an existential crisis and these sorts of things. And there are no easy answers to that. But the fact that these conversations are actually happening, I think, is really good. And so that's one thing that's ongoing. And then the other thing is the global stocktake. So that's the GST, and that's also going on now. It started in June and will go through next year. And that is where countries take stock of progress, both on mitigation, adaptation, and then what they call, again, here's more jargon, means of implementation, which is the finance, capacity building, and technology transfer. And so they're holding series of workshops, dialogues, what they're calling world cafes, where they're holding them around a bunch of different themes. So one of them being water. So there will be a whole roundtable on water for the first time at COP this year. So obviously for us, as partisans. We're very excited about that. But there's a number of other different topics that are being discussed and for people to come together and actually have conversation. And oftentimes there really isn't these informal spaces. They did one a couple years ago called the Talanoa Dialogue at COP24, 25, whichever was the Fiji COP.
24.
Yeah. So anyways, they've held something like that before, and it was really, I participated in that as well. And afterwards, all the countries were like, we need to do more of these. We need to have these informal spaces. And they haven't really done that since then. This is kind of the first time that they're doing that. And so hopefully that this is something that's going to continue, not just at the global COPs, but also the regional climate weeks that are now taking place for all of the different regions. Those are becoming more important as we're talking about implementing the Paris Agreement, the regional COPs, the dialogues that are taking place there, involving more stakeholders. Because really, you're at this global space, and it's so abstract, and you know, these are very fancy people and ministers and those sorts of things. And they, you know, they come and they say the things that they need to say, but when we're actually talking about implementation, you need a lot more people in the room. You need technical folks, you need stakeholders, local communities, all of those sorts of things. And these are spaces for them to actually participate, you know, and try and make this a more meaningful process.
One of the things, sort of threads through a lot of this has, to me, has been sort of the like workforce development component of this, right? Like, John, you talked about sort of being by yourself at the COP in 2007 or 8, right? And now there's, isn't there like a water pavilion at the COP?
Yes.
Like, this, right, there's like this whole, but there's still...
We actually have a hot tub there.
Yeah.
Very welcoming. Yeah, I have a Hawaiian shirt that I wear at the COP. Yeah.
That's a good visual. But thinking about like sort of that capacity building, having people, having sort of professionals who can connect the water space to the climate space, to the food space, to the infrastructure, right? Like thinking across all of these sectors and having a workforce that is sort of literate when it comes to the different languages across those sectors and to policy levers, right? And connecting that to policy. So can you talk about, since you've been working in this space for so long, how you've seen that evolve? And like, do we have the workforce that we need? Or do you see sort of an over the horizon sort of development of that?
It's such a good question. I think a part of it goes in the COP process, it goes a little bit to why is water there? And I think that there's still a lot of people in the water community that they think that they are there to kind of come down off the mountain with their IWRM tablets and read, you know, all the commandments, and then people will be happy. I think the most useful thing that water can do in the COP process is say, we're here to help, and we want to listen hard, and we also need to learn your words. So I mean, Ingrid and I are hardcore water people, but we have invested a lot of time to kind of learn what the problems of the climate community are, and to be able to say, these are ways that resilient water management can be really powerful. On the other side, I would say that, you know, we spend much more time actually in a way is turning back to the water community and say, you need to check yourself, and you need to really think about about. You are not managing. If you're telling me that this is something that like you would have come up in a list of three things to do in 1995, that is not resilient water management. The time for no regrets adaptation, that's gone. Yeah, and don't show me like another map that shows that Spain and India and the Colorado River are red. There is no easy water anymore. We have to think, you know, about not the floods in Pakistan right now. We need to think about the next flood after Pakistan, which is going to be worse, and it's probably going to be followed by a drought that was even worse than the one they had in the 2010s. So, we need to get our own house in order. And there's a lot of work that we need to do on the water community to actually make sure that the work that we're doing is something that's going to last. I mean, the same tools and approaches and technologies that we used to build the Hoover Dam, you know, for that lost climate that disappeared 40 years ago in the Colorado River, like that's the stuff that we're selling to Ethiopia. That's the stuff that we're selling to China. We are really often the agents of fragility and not resilience.
Wow.
And that's that I really try to distinguish between sustainability and resilience. And I think there are a lot of people in the water community that they haven't really kind of taken the hard truth home that says that the water cycle is far more dynamic than we thought it was. And we need to manage, you know, sustainability is like a balance point. And the reason I wear the Hawaiian shirt is I want to surf Sharma. I want to ride those waves and the highs and the lows.
I'm going to yes and you there to say yes, but also I think it is starting to change.
It really is.
And I think that, like, there's a lot to be positive about, like, the future direction that our water friends are moving. And the Water Pavilion, which you mentioned, is one of those spaces. I mean, that did not exist until last year was the first time that ever happened. And for a lot of the folks, the water folks who went there, it was the first time they'd ever engaged in a COP before.
Yeah.
It's totally new.
It's a socialization process, which totally. We also went through.
Right. When I started this work, you know, my background's in water resources management. It's not in climate change.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a degree in climate. I did a master's program that was an excellent water resources program, but it really didn't have climate in it. I had to learn that afterwards myself.
Mostly just by showing up.
Right, exactly. And talking to people and having those conversations and trying to understand how we do things differently. But that actually, it reminds me of what we're talking about all the time. Like, we're talking about resilience and the resilience of our folks as well to also be able to, you know, not only of policies or plans or projects, but also the people that are involved. And they have to be learning these new things across different,
yeah.
you know, expertises. We don't need people who are hyper specialized. We need people who have some understanding of all
exactly.
of these different industries, sectors, et cetera. And so one of the things that, you know, we are trying to do is really, yeah, work both sides of the coin. So working both in the climate space and then also on the water side.
That's why everybody hates us.
No.
Doing something right on the earth doesn't mean
right.
Yeah. That's
pretty true.
I don't get the sense that that's true.
It's not.
So looking forward, what are some of the new solutions that you have seen sort of percolating that you think might be promising in the water sector?
That's a great question. I feel like nature-based solutions have been a hugely hyped area. And they're both good and bad reasons for that. One of the things I would like to trademark as a personal phrase is that we need to take the BS out of NBS. A lot of that is that we, you know, nature-based solutions cannot solve every problem. They are not equally useful even when there are other alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do not want my son's school to be protected by a mangrove forest when a seawall would be much better.
Mm-hmm.
That said, you know, maybe we need to move the school and really change the kind of terms of the argument. But I feel like once you get past the hype, and it's probably still about 60-70% hype, there's been a very fundamental change, with the nerds, with the technical people like us, around NBS, and I'm hearing it from places that have never talked about it before.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's really interesting. And it's also not just can we put a wetland there. It's also like a kind of much more of a portfolio approach in terms of thinking about NBS and kind of what are the adaptation benefits that they provide, and can we count them? Can we like run it through a regular project development cycle? Can we make it a kind of a consistent outcome, or at least like one of the spectrum of choices that we might have that comes out of a larger program? And those are really useful. And I'll give like my kind of quick favorite example, which I don't like to usually give examples from the U.S., but this one is kind of special and innovative from the U.S., and for some reason it hasn't gotten that much exposure. But about 3 years ago, California started to experiment with the idea that they have had a fantastic nature-based solution that is widespread in almost anywhere where there are mountains and snow for centuries, which is their snowpack in the Sierra Nevada. And as temperatures have risen, more winter precipitation falls as rain instead of snow. It melts faster, and it also means that you have more floods in the winter. What they've done is said, you know, we don't have just a drought problem, and we don't have just a flood problem. Those are actually symptoms of the same problem. Mm-hmm. And so they developed a program. It's called FloodMAR, Managed Aquifer Recharge, where it links both of these in a really interesting way. It in the winter, it redirects the floodwater to farmers' orchards, to nut farms, to vineyards, to fallow fields, and it lets the water sit there, and then it infiltrates. And what that means is that they have moved from one nature-based solution of snowpack to another nature-based solution of aquifers. And they've linked both of those. And then last December, they kind of pitched this to other basins across the state. At least a dozen other basins in the state are now going to adopt this. And the governor in California, Gavin Newsom, in August, he announced a really interesting approach. He'd already placed early in his governorship that the water resilience, he made this an executive order on World Water Day when he was of his first year. He said water resilience has to be at the center of California's economy. And then he mandated three state agencies to lead with that. This is one of those programs. And in August of this year, he announced a water scarcity plan. He said, you know, we are having a 1,200-year drought now. What happens if we lose 10% more water? Mm-hmm. And it happens, say, by 2035, 2040. How do we deal with that? We need to have new water. When I first saw the headline, I thought, oh, he's going to build a, like, 20 desal plants. Mm-hmm. And that's not what he's doing. What he's doing is primarily is expanding this FloodMAR program. That's the new water. And what he's really trying to do is say, actually, resilience is how we keep California like a place that you want to live in, that we keep our communities and ecosystems healthy, and people still want to invest in it. That's a complete change of argument. And it's an approach. Like I think of the floodwaters that hit Pakistan. Like now I think it's kind of a waste. Like we should have been pushing that water to places where it could be infiltrating, because the other issue in Pakistan, of course, is the extreme droughts that they have in exactly the same places where they have the floods.
Yeah, we had the Pakistani foreign minister here a couple weeks ago, and he talked about that, and he talked about how, like, in the recovery, there needs to be resilience built in, right? Yeah. And making sure that whatever the rebuilding looks like, it's going to be with a mindset of what's next in terms of flooding and drought, and how do we make sure that we're rebuilding in ways that are going to be resilient. That's really interesting. And as a California native, I appreciate your example, because we are always cutting edge.
And so good looking.
Totally.
and pro Hawaiian shirt.
Yes, of course, always.
That's a really great example, too, of California. But I'm curious, you know, looking at these nature-based solutions and also the tracker and other work that you're doing, who are your key partners on this, and who are the unlikely partners that you found through your work?
Well, I mean, AGWA was founded as a network, and with a very early insight back in 2010 that there were essentially kind of independent insights that were arising in different disciplines, in economics, in hydrology, in governance and law, in engineering, planning, ecology, all of these areas, like we were starting to think about what adaptation and resilience meant for water, but we weren't thinking about it together. And so Agua, at its root, like we started with about 25, 30 members. We're around 2,300 globally now. It's always been about how do we bridge those disciplinary divides, and what has become is also how we bridge institutional divides too in perspectives, so that we have development banks that are learning from civil society, that are learning from private equity, you know, and water management agencies. So that's all really interesting, you know, and it's kind of what keeps Ingrid and I and the other members on the staff like really excited, because it's a job where we get to learn from our network. A lot of our work and practice is not at kind of the level of individual projects. It's at what I call a decision-making scale. It's like as a network we'll define, this is a target that we need to hit. We need to think about how the bonds market actually could be an instrument for rapidly scaling water-centric resilience. How would that work? And then crowdsourcing inside the network to build the tools literally across all those disciplines, so that you have, you know, you have a conservation biologist that's next to an OECD economist. You know, that's really cool.
We throw really good dinner parties. Like a really good.
Yeah, a little Manhattan fueled. Not talking about the city.
That's fantastic. Well, okay, so we'll look forward to catching up with you after the COP and hearing about all of the good dinner parties, but about how all of your conversations go there. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, I'm really glad to be here.
You've been listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.